Judge Hendel would.
Who's now studying at Bar Ilan. When he was 3 or 4 years old, it was Tisha B'Av, and I said Echa in the shul, and people said Yasher Koach and so forth, and he was very quiet, and I said to him, what did you think of the way I said Echa? And he said, you know, your voice is okay, but you really don't know Hebrew. Now, since no one corrected me, and I was just reading a parak that someone else wrote, I assumed he was referring to my accent. I was annoyed a little bit. My American accent was heavier then, in Hebrew. I was annoyed a little bit, and I said, you know what I do for a living? At the time, I was a prosecutor. And he thought, and he said, do you work in English? So now he's going to see that I continue to work in English here. In terms of what Rav Avraham said, I'll just very briefly say that's exactly the kind of approach that I was speaking of. I think it's very, very important that halacha deal with this issue with the seriousness that it deserves. Rav Soloveitchik said that there's a 614th commandment, which is that one must believe that halacha has the tools to deal with any situation at any time in any place. And that's also connected with a lot of the things that are happening in Bar Ilan, that there's a serious, not a superficial, a very serious attempt to deal with issues, whether it's in law and psychology and technology and so forth. And this is in itself, it's something that's very important that has to be done. It's interesting because, as Rav Avram pointed out, legal systems try to create new categories. And that's why the solution, I believe, that most legal systems would give to it would not be theft, but rather would try and give it this type of action a new name. Halacha, because it so treasures precedent, would try and expand the pre-existing concept, which is exactly what has happened here. And this is perhaps the most extreme example of Gnevat Da'at. And also, even though this case is very theoretical, perhaps one of the interesting things about thinking about it in that way is that we perhaps should take the concept of Gnevat Da'at much, much more seriously in our daily lives and in our connections with other people.
Yeah, I would like to comment, though, tell my panelists how this would be handled, or a similar case was handled by the Ethics Committee, and see what your reaction to that is. We, of course, never had a case like this, but on two occasions at Columbia, we had the issue of post-mortem sperm removal raised, where a wife, in one case, the patient was not yet dead, but he was dying, and the wife wanted his sperm taken from him. He could not give consent so that it would be frozen, and in that case, she actually wanted it because should one of their existing children ever have a disease that she would need a bone marrow transplant for, she could take it from the child, because one of their children, I think, had cancer in the past. The other case was in the situation of a man who had a devastating stroke, a brainstem stroke following a heart bypass operation, and the patient was alive. He and his wife were undergoing fertility treatments at the time because she could not get pregnant. But she had not gotten pregnant, and she felt he was probably going to die, and she wanted his sperm for the purposes of conceiving a child that they had wanted to conceive prior to his having the operation and the stroke. It was very dramatic, actually. We went into his room, and we tried to communicate with him through his blinking his eyes. He had a brainstem stroke, a locked-in syndrome, and we went in with two lawyers to see if we could obtain his consent to this question, and the man actually died as we approached him. It was a very, if it were on television, you would turn the channel and say, this is too corny. At any rate, in both cases, we decided not to grant the wish of the wife, pure and simple, because it was felt that we would not do this without the consent of the man, that for a person to father a child, even in a case where the father was clearly interested in fathering a child when he was well, we could not assume that this would be his wishes after his death, and therefore something of the enormity of fathering a child we could not carry out without the consent. of the father. And the only way in which our assisted reproductive technology people at Columbia would do it is if they actually had some written testimony prior that the patient would say, in case of my death, I give permission for my sperm to be removed for the purposes of fertility. I'd like to know the thoughts of my panelists on that.
It's an interesting question because the issue has come up in a different variant in Israeli law where a soldier, mm-hmm. after he died, you have a period of 72 hours where you can remove the sperm, and there was his girlfriend wished to remove the sperm. There was a lot of talk about this, actually, that the judge who handled the case said that we don't have to assume that that only a wife could request this. We also should ask the parents. We also can assume that he would have wanted this. I think the result was very incorrect, to my way of thinking, for several reasons. First of all, I think if the issue of consent is important, you should receive consent. I'm not sure. I'm sorry. The result was they said that you could remove the sperm in that particular case. It didn't go up to a higher court. It was a local family court. It didn't go up higher. And I think it's unfortunate these questions are not. It's interesting that sometimes when you have an ethics committee, they can be stricter than a court. I mean, it's interesting. I don't know. These raises other questions. I don't know whether consent is always the primary factor. I think we sometimes exaggerate the importance of consent. Just to take this example of becoming a father after death, Rav Aviner said that there are instances where someone is a yatom, and it's very, very tragic. And we relate to a yatom, someone who's an orphan, who doesn't have both parents, as something very tragic. Why should we, to begin with, set up a situation like that? Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to suggest is the questions are very, very profound regarding whether we want to do this to a child. A child should be born in this way. Legally, the arguments are very strong. Someone made the argument in that case, it's better this way because now we know who the donor is and the child can have grandparents and uncles and so forth. Just how clever lawyers can be. They turn this, what I think is a disadvantage, into an advantage. I don't know, again, I think consent should be clear. I wonder, it's similar a question, the autopsy questions, whether consent is as critical as it seems. It may be a condition, it may not be the only condition. Sometimes it matters, sometimes it doesn't matter. Modern law takes the approach that we not only have to ask the deceased, but also his wife, also his parents. These are good rules. I don't know, because we're at a point where this area of law is just developing and we should be more careful. I don't know whether inherently it's relevant. In other words, I don't know if a person wants to do this and it's allowed and it should be done, whether the fact that his parents don't want to do it should be relevant at all, but we're very, very careful about that. But I see that as really a different kind of area, which really relates to the question of in this case, perhaps you could assume that he would want to help his child if it's limited to that kind of situation, and you do not have the autopsy problems. And it may be that for this kind of example, because you're talking about something very specific, you're not talking about creating a new life, but you're talking about having a situation where you can help the child, where the assumption might be, I might, if I heard a case like that, be interested in hearing evidence to somehow overcome the fact that he didn't have in the second story, where it was very dramatic, where he couldn't really blink his eyes in time to say it, I might want to perhaps receive the consent from the circumstances mm-hmm. surrounding it.
Yeah. Would you apply the issue of genevat dat in general to a post-mortem sperm retrieval in a circumstance where you had no idea of the wishes of the, say, father, and the wife said, I want my husband's sperm to get pregnant with, and we had no idea of the wishes of the father? Would you use the principle of genevat dat there and not take the sperm?
בקשר לשאלה, אני אתחיל עם השאלה הראשונה. בקשר לשאלה הראשונה, דווקא התחושה שלי שאני לא רואה למה לא לעשות את זה. צריך להבחין פה כמובן בין כמה אספקטים. יש את האספקט של הפגיעה בזכותו של האבא, ש... שעומד להיפטר מן העולם, ויש את הפגיעה בילד העתידי. במובן המשפטי הטהור, פגיעה בילד עתידי זה לא אישו, כי הוא עדיין לא נמצא כאן. זה כמו מה שקוראים, נדמה לי לפחות, מה שקוראים משפטנים, הולדה בעוולה. הולדה בעוולה זה מצב שבו ילד תובע את הוריו, או את לא משנה, את הרופא שייעץ להוריו, למה הם הביאו אותו לעולם, הוא היה רוצה לא להיות פה. מוטב לו לאדם שלא נברא. אז לכן אני לא חושב שהוא בכלל נמצא כאן, לפחות ברובד הפורמלי, הוא נמצא כאן כמישהו שהוא צד בעניין. בקשר לאבא, אם האבא הראה רצון ברור לעשות את זה, כי בסך הכל הוא עשה את המאמצים עם אשתו, אז מה הבעיה בזה? אז אני לא רואה, למה לא להניח שאם הוא מסכים, אז אפשר
לעשות? אבל הוא היה בחיים, אז אנחנו לא יודעים מה שהוא היה רוצה לעשות אם הוא היה נפטר.
הוא עשה את המאמצים לפני שהוא ידע שהוא במצב סופני. זה אולי, חשבתי שהוא כבר עשה את זה תוך כדי בגלל זה. אז זה באמת שאלה יותר קשה כבר. אז זה כבר שאלה יותר קשה, למרות שעדיין, אני לא חושב שאם אנחנו עושים אומדנה במקום, הרי בסך הכל מה שאנחנו יכולים לעשות, אנחנו יכולים להיכנס לראשו של האבא, מה האדם הסביר במצב כזה היה אומר. ואני חושב שהאדם הסביר במצב כזה כן היה רוצה לשתף פעולה עם אשתו, אבל פה באמת זו שאלה יותר של פשוט לבדוק ולראות. אני לא חושב שזאת קטגוריה חדה, הלכתית.